Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a just-released report from the World Meteorological Organization that finds the global warming gas CO2 grew more rapidly last year than its average rise over the past decades. Meteorologist Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University and author of The Hockey Stick and The Climate Wars, joins us to discuss the report and his own wars with the just-defeated candidate for governor, Virginia's Attorney General Cuccinelli, who began a witch hunt against Michael Mann, accusing the climate scientist of fraud. Then, with the poor being punished by cuts in food stamps, we will look into how the unemployed are about to be punished, with 1.3 million Americans losing unemployment insurance at the end of the year, according to a new report from the National Employment Law Project. The author of that report, Rebecca Dixon, joins us to discuss the chronic federal underfunding of states' unemployment programs, burdened by extensive backlogs and outdated and unreliable systems, which in California alone have delayed payments on 300,000 claims. Then finally, we will discuss oral arguments in the Supreme Court on an important church versus state case with Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, who has an article at the Daily Beast, Supreme Court Prayer Decision in Greece versus Galloway Should Be Easy. Joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org, and in 2007 he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Hi, it's good to be with you, Ian.
And Michael, I had no idea that you were in the midst of climate wars against this anti-science zealot, Ken Cuccinelli, the Attorney General of the state of Virginia, who just lost the race for governorship. He went on this jihad, this witch hunt against you starting in 2010. Tell our audience about what happened, how he wasted thousands of the taxpayers' money in the state of Virginia on a crusade against a climate scientist, charging you with fraud.
Sure, yeah. He, in fact, forced the University of Virginia to spend the better part of $500,000, and who knows how much taxpayer money he actually spent in this over the course of this crusade. Ken Cuccinelli is, you know, a classic so-called Tea Party Republican. He has ultra-conservative views on a range of topics, and he's a denier of climate change. He denies the basic science of climate change. And what he tried to do was to accuse me of fraud because I was working on the science of climate change, and he considers that science fraudulent, of course, because it doesn't comport with his ideological views. And so he tried to use this what's known as a civil subpoena as Attorney General to force the university to turn over thousands of emails between me and 39 different climate scientists around the world, presumably so he could find something to embarrass us with. After all, you know, he was the recipient of quite a bit of fossil fuel money that fund his campaigns. So this was widely seen for what it was by reasonable people as an effort by a fossil fuel-funded politician to intimidate scientists whose findings, you know, might be inconvenient to the special interests that he represents. And the courts, the lower court rejected it. He appealed to the state Supreme Court. It rejected the case with prejudice, meaning that they really didn't want to see him ever come back to the court with something like that again. And so it was, I was relieved that he was defeated yesterday. In fact, I actively campaigned with his opponent, Terry McAuliffe, over the past several months because I understood what a stark contrast this race represented. On the one hand, you have Terry McAuliffe, who believes in science and technology and innovation and recognizes that's the way we're going to grow the economy, and Ken Cuccinelli, who sees science as something to attack if it doesn't comport with his ideological views.
So, Michael Mann, if you were stumping for Terry McAuliffe, what was your impression of how your arguments are being received? Because the problem is that we live in a culture where the truth is a moving target, where people do reality shopping, and right, faith sometimes trumps fact.
That's right. Yeah, and that's why we really have to fight back against the efforts to mislead the public, disinformation campaigns like those funded by the fossil fuel industry to confuse the public about the science. That's why I've argued that scientists play an important role in trying to inform this discourse and trying to cut through the nonsense and the disinformation and the falsehoods that are promoted by front groups for the fossil fuel industry, groups working for the Koch brothers, who are doing their best to confuse the public about basic issues of science, like the science of climate change, because they find it inconvenient, the notion that we have to do something about our escalating carbon emissions.
Well, you have to add to the list of the Koch brothers, Rupert Murdoch, the owner of many newspapers and Fox News. He just helped get this climate denier in Australia, elected Prime Minister.
Right.
Now, on the
That's
platform
right.
of climate denial against the carbon tax that was enacted by the previous government.
That's right. And in fact, in Australia, of course, Murdoch controls much of the media, but he has a controlling interest in News Corp, which means in the U.S., the Wall Street Journal, Fox News, in the U.K., a number of tabloids. He has a huge media empire in the form of News Corp, and he's using that media empire to, again, to disinform the public, to confuse the public. Now, here's one thing that most people don't realize, they're not aware of. News Corp has a controlling interest when you combine Rupert Murdoch and the second largest shareholder, which is Kingdom Holding. That's the Saudi royal family. Together with Rupert Murdoch, they have a controlling share of News Corp, and they are using that media empire to basically to confuse the public about the threat of climate change. It's a deeply immoral activity that they are engaged in.
So the Saudis, because they're an oil economy, they're against global warming because they want to keep selling fossil fuels. And Murdoch's got a climate change denier now as Prime Minister of Australia. So
it's
amazing,
isn't
it?
Or the other place, perhaps. Yep.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org, and in 2007 he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include...
Well, technically, I should be careful with the wording there. We contributed to the award of the Nobel Peace Prize.
I see. You didn't share in the loot.
We didn't actually get, a gold medal, no.
Okay, all right. But your books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines.
Yes.
Let's turn to the reason I was calling you, although I was so blown away when I found out that Cuccinelli had been on this jihad against you.
Yeah, a lot of news today. Yep.
So let's talk about the report that just came out from the World Meteorological Organization saying that the atmospheric CO2 grew more rapidly last year than its average rise over the past decades, and thanks to carbon dioxide and methane and other gases, the World Meteorological Organization says that the warming effect on our climate has increased by almost a third since 1990.
Yeah, that's right. We are, most people don't realize that we are actually escalating in our burning of fossil fuels and our generation of greenhouse gases because it isn't just industrial nations like the U.S. Who are burning fossil fuels and contributing to greenhouse gas emissions, but now we have developing nations like China and India and South America coming online with their own fossil fuel economies. And so global greenhouse gas emissions are increasing exponentially. It isn't just a constant rate of increase. The rate of increase is increasing. And that's why we project that if we continue with business as usual, fossil fuel burning, we will reach levels of CO2 in the atmosphere double their pre-industrial levels within a matter of decades. Now, here's something else. Earlier this year, we, for the first time on record, exceeded 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. For every million parts of atmosphere, 400 of them were CO2. Now, that may not sound like a large concentration, but pre-industrial levels were only 280, and we have to go back several million years to find levels of CO2 that exceeded that level, where CO2 was 400 parts per million in the atmosphere. We have to go back several million years to find CO2 concentrations that high. So we are engaged in this unprecedented experiment, this uncontrolled experiment, in the way that we are changing the composition of the atmosphere, warming the planet, and changing the climate.
So the World Meteorological Organization's report that just came out says, it points out that we exceeded the symbolic 400 parts per million in May of this year. But it also says that the global annual average of CO2 concentration will cross that threshold in 2015 or 2016. So we're definitely on the wrong track, right?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a large annual sort of cycle in CO2 levels as the world's plants collectively breathe in from the atmosphere and they breathe out. It's called the breathing of the biosphere. The Earth, like us, breathes in and breathes out with the seasons. And so CO2 concentrations are highest in the Northern Hemisphere summer. They come down in the Northern Hemisphere winter as plants stop photosynthesizing and taking in CO2. And we so there's this annual cycle, and we reached the peak of that annual cycle earlier this summer, and that peak went above 400 parts per million. Now it's coming back down. It'll go back up next summer, and it'll continue to wiggle. But on top of that wiggle is riding on an ever-upward trend. And so we hit the 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere for the first time this year during the upswing of that wiggle. But in a matter of a decade or two, we will be there even at the low side of that wiggle. And so we are, you know, we are continuing to ramp up the concentrations of these gases at a rate where, you know, in a couple decades, we will probably be crossing the 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere rather than 400. Why do I cite that number? That is the level of CO2 in the atmosphere we are fairly confident will give us a net warming of the planet of 2 degrees Celsius. That's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit relative to pre-industrial time. That's enough warming to lead to what can reasonably be described as dangerous and potentially irreversible changes in our climate.
And the rise of the ocean, too. I mean, that...
We, in fact, with the CO2 we are putting into the atmosphere right now, the ocean will continue to... sea levels will continue to rise for centuries because that heating of the atmosphere is slowly sinking into the ocean, down into the deep ocean, and it continues to contribute to sea level rise as those deep ocean waters warm and they expand. So the decisions we are making right now with our fossil fuel burning have implications for centuries to come in terms of the amount of sea level rise we'll see.
Well, Michael Mann, again, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, there's obviously some rather, I consider it quite pernicious, arguments going on in favor of nuclear power as a solution. Some climate scientists seem to have sort of drunk the nuclear industry's Kool-Aid. I'm always amazed at how the nuclear industry can stay in business after Three Mile Island and after Chernobyl and now after Fukushima, but... Something keeps them alive. They're like the ever-ready bunny, you know. But
I actually drove past Three Mile Island earlier today on my way down from State College to Harrisburg. So I'm aware of the impact that meltdown had. And, you know, in Fukushima, what we're doing here is we're trading off risks. They're different kinds of risks. They have different temporal timescales associated with them, different global footprints in terms of the regions that they influence, but there's no question that there are risks associated with nuclear energy as there are risks associated with fossil fuel burning. And the only truly safe route to meeting our growing energy needs is to incentivize clean, non-fossil fuel-based renewable energy like wind and solar and geothermal. There's enough of that to meet growing demands over the decades ahead. There are peer-reviewed scientific studies that show that we could meet 85% of our projected energy demand by 2050 from a combination of wind, solar, and geothermal. So we don't need to employ these riskier these riskier forms of energy generation.
But the other big hoax, I think, that's being played on the American people now, which is being funded by the natural gas lobby, who are buying up a lot of media, a lot of public media too, I might add, and lots of ads now on NPR stations about how fracking and how great it is for farmers making all this money. Right. My understanding is that there isn't really any good data out yet on the extent to which all of this fracking is opening up fissures that emit methane, and that these wellheads are emitting methane, and that this is a reckless system. This fracking has consequences that hasn't been measured. And if this industry can argue, that, which is scientifically factual, that natural gas creates much less pollution than coal, which is a fact, but it's not a win. It's a loss if they release methane, because methane is, what, 100 times worse in terms of global warming gases than CO2. So as far as I know, it's a wash.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it depends on the time scale you're talking about, because the problem with CO2 in particular is it's around for a very long time. Methane tends to disappear. It's scavenged from the atmosphere after a time frame of about a decade or so. So there are different sort of time horizons associated with these two different gases. But the bottom line is that there is a huge uncertainty here about how much methane is leaking into the atmosphere through hydraulic fracturing, fracking. There is not yet a scientific consensus about precisely how much of this fugitive methane is making it into the atmosphere. But what that means is that there is a huge and unknown risk associated with our continued reliance on natural gas under the assumption that somehow it's going to lower our net greenhouse gas emissions. As you allude to, while natural gas does produce less CO2 than coal per unit of power generated, about a factor or two less, that could easily be offset by the amount of methane that's put into the atmosphere. And there are other what we call externalities, environmental externalities, the damage potentially done to groundwater, the contamination of groundwater by the fracking process, by the chemicals that are used in fracking. And so what we have to look at the full footprint of environmental impacts associated with each of these methods of getting energy. And it isn't just the greenhouse gases put into the atmosphere. It's the environmental damage that's done, whether it's groundwater contamination in the case of fracking, whether it's destroying entire mountain ecosystems by blowing up the tops of mountains to get the coal that's buried underneath, or destroying the environment, the surrounding environment, by mining the tar sands up in Canada. Each of these fossil fuel-based energy sources has associated with it, a number of potential environmental impacts that we can't even truly evaluate. How do you put a dollar number on the value of the Gulf of Mexico and the ecosystems that it supports? How do you put a dollar value on the value of a mountain wilderness? How do you put a dollar value on, the Athabascan Plains of Canada? So we have to think about the true cost, the hidden cost of many of these sources of fossil fuel energy.
Well, I thank you for joining us here. And just in closing, the World Meteorological Organization's report that we're discussing here also says that concentrations of methane and nitrous oxide have broken previous records. So I thank you for joining us, Michael Mann.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And in 2007, he contributed to those who shared the Nobel Peace Prize on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how, after food stamps have been cut for the poor, now the unemployed are about to take a hit.
At least it's not the end of the world.